Welcome to a very special edition of Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Gina Columbus. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. But today, we had the pleasure of sitting down with Tanios Bakay-Saab, MD, FACP, who is a medical oncologist and medical director of the Cancer Clinical Research Office, vice chair and section chief of medical oncology in the Department of Internal Medicine at Mayo Clinic. Bakay-Saab is also on the selection committee for the Enclave Giants of Cancer Care program. He has been a leading oncologist in the gastrointestinal cancers field and has spearheaded several research efforts that have impacted clinical practice, such as the Phase 2 REDOSE trial, which evaluated a weekly regorafenib dose escalation strategy beginning at 80 milligrams and ending at 160 milligrams. Results showed that the approach was appropriate and potentially optimal for previously treated patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Bakay-Saab spent time discussing the path to practicing in gastrointestinal malignancies, how he navigates balancing his professional and personal life, and mottos he has lived by throughout his career and while caring for his patients.
The first question I had is really, what made you want to specialize in oncology, and specifically, what path led you to the GI cancer field?
When you join medical school, you start thinking about a lot of the specialties. You actually fall in love with a lot of the specialties you visit, and some you know that these are not in your purview. When I was a second-year medical student, going into my third, I started exploring thoughts about surgery versus internal medicine versus other potential specialties. I mean, I knew one thing for sure is that I wanted to be with the patients. So specialties like pathology and radiology were not interesting to me. I did from day one love that patient interaction, being able to sit with patients and have discussions and meet their families. So that eventually took me down the path of internal medicine. I mean, first I was fascinated by the pathophysiology of disease and how internists deal with problems, and then more and more interested with organs such as the liver and the pancreas, as favorites. There's no good reason why, other than I was just fascinated by liver and pancreas and the gastrointestinal tract physiology and pathology. And then in my fourth year, I started getting more exposed to oncology and hematology. And in all frankness, at first, this was 20 plus years ago. At first, medical oncology itself was not as interesting or appealing, as options were actually very few, far in between. Hematology sounded actually a bit more interesting, and transplant was fascinating. And I thought, actually, I'm going to end up as a transplanter. So I chose the field of internal medicine, and that's what I specialized in. And as I was always going through internal medicine, I was on the hematology wards and bone marrow transplant. I was still thinking, this is probably where I'm going. But I kept that fascination with hepatology and gastroenterology. The one thing that turned me off from gastroenterology, no offense to my colleagues in GI, is, it was too procedurally oriented, and I loved that contact with the patient, that constant contact and that humanity that comes out of hematology oncology. So I went into my fellowship, and I had an open mind, although I thought, again, I'm going to be a transplanter. And, in my first month in the transplant clinic, I decided, maybe not as much. I think my passion is a little bit elsewhere. And then I shifted to medical oncology, and GI was an area of great interest to me, and that's how I ended up in GI and GI oncology. Oncology overall, so just to give you a background, I mean, my training was actually in oncology and clinical pharmacology and experimental therapeutics. one of the main drivers, other than the patient contact, was the fact that oncology was one of the major drivers of drug development and understanding pathways and targeting pathways and new agents coming through and being part of the experimental therapeutics world. And that was one of the other major drivers that led me to oncology. So it's both the patient care aspect of things, and I think oncology, and I still think oncology, is probably one of the most humane and one of the most human specialties. At the same time, it was also the most fascinating scientifically, because that's where a lot of the discoveries, at least at the drug levels, were happening. And I could see then the transformation that was starting to occur at the time, which certainly consolidated my interest in cancer and gastrointestinal cancer specifically. Some of the biggest challenges were actually in GI. I remember when I graduated as a fellow, going into my first appointment, that all what we had were 5-FU, gemcitabine, and then irinotecan was just making it in. And the whole discussion was about whether you give 5-FU bolus versus infusional. And that was really all what you had in tools. But you could see through the clinical trials that were occurring that there were a lot of other interesting targeted options that were coming through, including anti-angiogenic agents and others at the time. So that probably traces back, although it's always difficult to pinpoint the exact point where you made that decision or why you thought what you did, but I think it's a cumulative of all these effects that led me into gastrointestinal cancer.
Wow, that's so interesting to think that, you know, if you hadn't made that decision, that you could have been, you know, a transplant surgeon instead.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
it's an evolution in some ways, and leads you, you know, to the path that makes you the happiest. You know, because if you in a way, if you think about it, if your job ends up being your hobby, then you're really very happy every day you make it to work. You know that you're doing something you really are passionate about and you really love to do. And that's what I feel doing what I do today.
That's great. That's the American dream, right? That's what everybody wants. That's so good. Even now, you know, all these years later, and you've had such an amazing career so far. What really kind of lies behind your passion to continue to search for a cure for these multitude of GI cancers?
So, you know, the biggest inspiration for us is our patients. I mean, they're in the field, they're fighting this. And we, till today, don't feel like we are close where we should be. Although, I can tell you, I mean, the changes that have occurred over the last few years, over the last two decades, have literally changed quite significantly how well we are getting our patients shepherded through their cancers, even the most dire and the most advanced cancers. The most interesting thing was in my first few years when my nurses, and especially the older nurses in the infusion unit that's regarding my pancreas cancer patients, you know, came to me and would say, you know, years ago, we meet a pancreas cancer patient, and it was a hello. We barely got to know them, and they passed. And it was very difficult to take care of those patients. And today, we're making friends with them and their families, and we see them a year or two after, and sometimes even more, which is pretty amazing. And that's just in a matter of a decade, 10 years. So even the most and the toughest cancer that we treat, in other words, pancreas cancer, the changes that have happened there have revolutionized, you know, how how we deal with these patients. And we're not curing most of our patients. We're not, at least with pancreas cancer, we're not changing necessarily their course beyond a few years. But those few years were definitely ahead of the few months, sometimes few weeks, that they were exposed to. So the changes are happening in every aspect of our field, and all of it has to do with, again, you know, sitting with this patient, sitting with the family, you know, understanding that there, when you talk about cancer, at any stage, the patient's first thought and their family's first thought is, I'm looking at death right in the face right now, and I want to find every reason possible to live and to live as long as I can while preserving the quality of life. And I think the changes have been made in both matters. One, we're changing the quantity. We're extending life quite significantly, and we still want to do better. The other one that actually I think where we've made a huge difference is in the way we support our patients through their journey, and that's the quality of life effect. So we started to understand a little bit more about the value of toning down treatment, giving breaks, dose reductions, anti-nausea medication, supporting our patients through diarrhea, supporting their families, having social workers available, having support groups, and having a very compassionate team taking care of the patients so the patients all through their journey feel that they're part of a family. And that's how I treat my patients, as if they were part of my family, but that's how my team overall treats them. So, you know, if you think about your family, you would do everything possible for your family members to be safe and to be able to live their lives as well as possible. And that's how we think about our patients with cancer, because we know what they're going through, both physically and psychologically. So I think, you know, the passion to continue to fight comes from the fact that, one, we've already made a big difference in the lives of our patients, both quantitatively and qualitatively, but two, that we're not there yet. I can see the light at the end of the tunnel, but I want actually to get out of the tunnel. I want my patients to get out of that tunnel. And so I think we're getting close. We're not there yet. And so my passion is to continue to fight for the rest of my career until I get my patients out of that tunnel.
Can you talk to me about maybe a patient or two that, you know, really kind of completely changed your practice or had a lasting impact on you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, when I think every individual patient has really had a very long-lasting impact one way or the other, you know, on me. But I recall very fondly one of my patients a few years ago, a high-powered lawyer who ended up with pancreas cancer. And essentially, I met him in the hospital. I got called by the surgeon and says, hey, can you meet this patient in the hospital? And it was 2 days after his surgery. He looked amazing. I mean, I couldn't believe that this guy had a Whipple. He was this, you know, little guy, very strong character. He had his laptop already in his bed, you know, doing some work. And this was 2 days after his surgery. And I met him, and we talked, and he says, hey, Dr. Saab, you know I'm going to beat this. I said, absolutely. I mean, we're in this fight together. And he says, you know, I told the surgeons I'm getting out tomorrow. I said, well, this is only 3 days after your Whipple. He says, I feel great. I'm going walking. I'm eating. I'm ready to get chemo. I said, well, no, let's just talk about it when you're out. So this, I called this one of the patient's characteristics, the patient warrior, who's ready just to take on his or her disease and just, you know, move forward and continue their life. So I see them in clinic. We talk about the need for chemotherapy. He said, I'm all in, but I have my schedule. It's pretty busy. I have to put you between, you know, this time slot and this time slot. I start, you know, I smile and I look at his wife and she looks at me and she shrugs her shoulder and she says, you know, you have to work with the doctor. This is your life. You understand? He says, I'll try, but, you know, I mean, I have my schedule. So goes through chemotherapy very patiently, you know, always had his laptop on him, and then he essentially ends up finishing his chemo as well. Unfortunately, his cancer comes back. He comes back and metastatic, as most of these pancreas cancers come. He comes back, we meet, we talk about the scans. Obviously, a little disappointed, but he says, doc, I understand. I understand your plan for me. I understand that this is a bad cancer, but I want to fight, and I'll fight as hard as I can. But I also want to continue working full-time. I own this practice, and I travel all over the world for my practice, and I want to continue doing this while getting the chemo. Indeed, for 3 years, which, back then for pancreas cancer is amazing by itself, for 3 years with stage 4 cancer, this patient was getting his chemotherapy, went to every meeting he had across the world, came back for his chemo, made essentially a goal to go on Mount Kilimanjaro and attempted others as well with his friends. So he tried as much as possible to continue living a normal life, a fulfilled life, while going through chemotherapy, and continued to work full-time, running his practice. Every time I saw him in clinic, occasionally he had to wait a little bit longer, and he had his laptop in his lap, essentially just going through work, and always as pleasant as ever. Until the last day, I remember he gave me a call while he was in hospice, and he says, "Hey, Dr. Saab, anything else you can think about? Anything else can maybe reverse this?" And I had the frank discussion with him at that point. And he says, "I understand. You tried your best, but I feel like in this short amount of time, I pretty much fulfilled everything I want. Understanding that time is limited, I really want to thank you for everything you've done, and I want you to understand that my death is not a defeat. I actually defeated cancer in many ways by being able to live as normal of a life as possible." So it was it. And I stayed very close, to his family, met with his family a few times after death, even socially, they got to know my family. And it was very important in many ways, and his wife was quite involved with pancreas cancer advocacy and working with our research and working even volunteering time in our clinic. So it was wonderful all over the place, but that's an example of the difference, not only that the patient makes, that you make in the patient's life, but what the patient and their family can make in your life. Although I lost the patient, and we, if you think about how we're trained in medical school, we're trained that if for whatever reason your patient dies, then you haven't done the job. I mean, that's how clinicians are trained. You have to take care of the problem and keep the patient alive. In this situation, I think it reminds us about with this particular patient and other patients, of course. It reminds you about one, how important it is to ensure that the patient is able to maintain, despite a very dire prognosis, to maintain the best quality of life possible while extending their life. And that's a win. And that we understand that, in these situations and others, we know that for many patients with cancer, you will not prevent death. But if you actually have them win through their life, that's already a win. And if you make sure that they go through their last few days with the most dignity and comfort possible, then you've always won. That's one of those cases. And of course, every patient that goes through the same journey has a similar impact on how we practice. And I see this case and others that I see on a daily basis as one of the main reasons why I love my job, because I actually am able to make sure that my patients are able to, a human being is able to go through the most difficult diagnosis with the most comfort and the most dignity you can afford them, despite a very bad diagnosis. And of course, we have a lot of patients who essentially are cured from their cancer, and we navigate them in different ways. But that is one example of a patient who really, you know, left quite a big impact and obviously, you know, kept a good relationship with his family for years to come and still am.
I know that, you know, you travel all over. You're constantly at, you know, so many different conferences and trips that you're, you know, domestic and international all over. I give you so much credit for doing it. How do you kind of really, you know, you're speaking about, you know, family, and how do you really kind of handle that work-life balance? And is there advice that you can give to other oncologists, you know, maybe especially in the GI field on really trying to, you know, have that kind of balance between your job and your personal life?
As physicians overall, and especially in the cancer field, oftentimes you have to remind yourself about your priorities. If you don't, your patients will. Oftentimes, when I tell my patients who are there going through chemotherapy and through treatment, you know, I'm not going to be able to see you next time, because I'll be traveling to Japan or traveling, and they look at you and say, "Hey, doc, remember, most important thing, you have to make sure that you spend time with those kids and with this beautiful wife of yours." And so they will remind you, and then you look at them and you think, you know what, life can be so fleeting and coming and going so quickly. What you learn from oncology is that it's important to keep you know, a good balance and keep your personal life alive and happy. And so part of what I do is making sure that every time I'm going to spend, not traveling or out of work, I'm going to spend it with my family. I'm going to spend every minute of it, and that's what I do. I actually learned to adapt even my travel in a way that as much as possible, I try not to get my weekends interrupted from travel. On rare occasions they are. I almost never skip a Sunday unless it's a big meeting like ESMO or ASCO. Every Sunday I am home, even if I have to get back at midnight on Saturday. But I try to get the whole weekend back with my family. And that time is 100% dedicated to them. And frankly, at the end of the day, if it's dedicated to them, it's dedicated to myself. You also need to have hobbies. I think at the end of the day, to keep your mind off work and off things, you know, whatever your hobby is, you know, I started to learn to hit balls. I'm not a golfer, but, you know, living in Arizona, you have to essentially take advantage of the beautiful courses, and it keeps your mind off and it relaxes you. And you know, from time to time, also get with friends. One of the advantages, and sometimes it's undersold, of being at conferences is connecting with peers. There was an old study that essentially looked at, you know, with the tough jobs oncologists have, because, again, we're at this, you know, we have this tough job of navigating life and death oftentimes. For some, you know, it may be quite tough. And one of the things that is therapeutic is essentially connecting with peers and discussing essentially practices and patients and things like that. And that study actually suggested that the level of satisfaction on the job for oncologists goes up quite significantly when they have the opportunity to connect with peers in different variety of settings, smaller meetings or larger meetings. And I think that's important. Oftentimes we see it as work and we're like, another travel. Geez, I don't want to do that. I'd rather just be home and jump in the pool or whatever. But the reality is actually these become very important, not just for their educational value or your presenting, but it's also, you know, connecting with other peers that are going through, you know, that practice in the same manner, that are going through some of the difficulties you may be going through on the job, etc.
Great advice. Is there anything that, you know, you're really looking forward to maybe over the next couple of years? Anything related, like with research you're working on, or just things that are happening in the GI cancer field that you'd like to share?
This is one of the most exciting times in oncology, and in GI oncology in particular, but in oncology overall. I think between, you know, understanding more the value of this precision medicine or precision oncology that's coming onto us, and then immune therapy, immune oncology, and you know, understanding also the you know, the evolving field of epigenetics and other areas as well, and big data. I think we're at a turning point in the way, you know, we're able to treat our patients. So, for example, you know, in colorectal cancer, you know, we're starting to understand, just to take colorectal as an example, we're starting to understand the value of breaking down this disease into multiple subgroups based on the genetic alteration or epigenetic alterations or others as well, signatures, and target those patients specifically, you know, based on their alterations. So there are some large platforms, including one that's emanating from our network, Colomate, that is looking at matching patients specifically to the alteration with multiple arms. You know, today we know that at least with, for example, the MSI-high patients and the high tumor mutational burden, that we can literally cure patients with a PD-1 inhibitor. We have all in our clinics, you know, a number of these examples, including some patients where we've seen, you know, the Lazarus effect. You know, patients were near death and came back not only to life, but then they lived their life and they continue to have patients who are 4 or 5 years out, including, you know, patients that were treated on that first pembrolizumab study that led to the approval of pembrolizumab. Patients with colon cancer and with pancreas cancer. I mean, I have a patient with pancreas cancer that is now 5 years out, metastatic disease, had Lynch syndrome with MSI high, with pembrolizumab, only exposed for a little bit less than a year, and I continue getting cards from her and notes from her. She's still alive and flourishing. And I think that, you know, this is one example of many. We can make a big difference, the NTRK fusions, the HER2 amplifications. So we're at the tip of the iceberg. You know, in lung cancer, they've done a phenomenal job, you know, working through the different targets and matching those to targets and with patients having, again, responses that you would never expect from a single agent, from a single tyrosine kinase inhibitor. So I'm very excited about the future of oncology and more specifically in GI oncology. And I think that we're really just at the tip of the iceberg. And once we uncover the rest of the iceberg, I am pretty confident that we're going to cure most cancers regardless of what stage they're at in the next few years.
Well, that's very uplifting, and thank you for sharing all of that. You covered a lot of ground today. Is there anything else that perhaps I didn't ask you about, but you really want to let our listeners know?
Well, I think that I would say that, you know, in your clinic, as your motto, so that's one of your questions there, in the daily practice, the most important thing is always to remember to keep a smile on, to exert the utmost compassion for the patients and their family, to give them the time they deserve. Occasionally, if the patient wants, you give them a hug, you hold their hand. You give them hope as long as it's not false hopes, and most importantly, you keep a dose of realism. And that's my personal motto in clinic, and you give it the best shot you can.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing all of this. I really, really appreciate it, Dr. Saab.
No, my pleasure.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this special episode of Enclave On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews with top KOLs in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Enclave and at Enclave SOSS. On Facebook, like us at Enclave and Enclave State of the Science Summit, and follow us on our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of Enclave On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave On Air.